Mel.
What you do for this winter, you put in this stuff called shock. First of all, the pool is salt water. Two bags of salt water, and you got to watch. You got to check the, you know, the content, the chlorine, and the salt water, and you know all that stuff. But for the winter, you pour in a bag. It's called shock, and that's what it does. It prevents the pool from freezing over. It prevents algae buildup and a whole bunch of other things. And then in the summer, as soon as you open the pool back up, you run the filter. You start to run it. Goes through the filter and removes that. It just filters out, and that's basically the pool maintenance that you go through. And so this little pump doesn't deliver approximately, it's good for about a little over a gallon a minute, Dick, over.
I'm hearing about a saltwater pool for the first time in my life. I never knew that people would set up a pool in their backyard running on salt water. Where did the original salt water come from? And the shock material, how can the material that keeps the pool from freezing, which sounds like it dissolves in the water, I'm having trouble believing that an ordinary filter can take dissolved material back out. What percentage of the people with a backyard pool are using salt water in their pool? That's amazing to me, Mel. Go ahead.
Quite a number of them. In fact, on this block, there's five pools. And every one of them is salt water. It starts out first, after the pool was installed, you just let your hose run, putting in regular city water, and then you start pouring in the sacks of salt that they sell at the pool supply. You put them in, and you keep checking the with this sort of little thing they give you, I guess it's like a hydrometer, until you build it up to a certain, I think it's about 3% salt in the water. And that's been a very popular system of now of for the pools for the last number of years. And yeah, this stuff shock does dissolve out. It's a neutralizer that you put in, and it dissipates. It's specifically made for it. That's the name of the product, shock, that is used for closing pools every year, Dick, over.
What is the motivation for taking city water, which is fresh water, and pouring salt in to make it salt water? What makes people desire to swim in salt water, Mel? Go ahead.
Seems like they like it more than using, you know, regular pools that have chlorine in it. A lot of people don't like that chlorine. They said it burns their eyes. They said if you get it in your mouth, it's got terrible taste and everything. A lot of complaints, irritation, oh yeah, skin irritation, very much in complaints. They said that when they go down to the ocean, to the beach, they usually have no problem enjoying the salt water in the beach, you know, the regular Atlantic Ocean here. So they find that if they basically duplicate the same thing in their pool in the backyard, they're very happy with it, Dick, over.
Appears to be greater buoyancy in salt water and to aerosol.
Yeah, the buoyancy I can see, but does the salt water, not only does it create less allergies with some people, is it any better as far as the algae that wants to grow in the pool? Is it easier to keep undesirable things from growing in the pool when it's a salt water pool? Mel, go ahead.
I'm not sure, really, you know, whether straight pools with chlorine versus salt, what is really the algae situation. I don't know, because once a week you go over the pool, you get the vacuum unit out. You know, it's a hose that connects onto your pump, and you sort of, you know, clean the pool. You whatever little algae starts to form down in the bottom of the pool, you clear out. And they got these sacks of stuff that they sell, the salt, and got other additives in it to it, and keeps the water pretty pristine, I'll say that much. The water is clean, mostly. Mostly leaves from trees and things like that that fall into the, you know, water. But with a little bit of effort, it seems like you can maintain pretty clean water, Dick, over.
Fascinating. I've been living a naive life. Never heard of that before. Okay. How's your mailbag, Mel? KQLIW.
Just wanted to mention, I someday like to do some more experimenting again with solar energy. It would be interesting if I could get that little pump to work with solar panels so that we'd be completely green. But it doesn't use much in the way of electric compared to what the cost of heating a pool with gas, natural gas, is for the summer. It is actually costless, no cost really to speak of. I had a lot of questions that were asked not only the other day, the number of questions were asked about a program that was on PBS, but I also got questions that were asked on 10 meters net. 10 meters net that we have on Sunday morning.
Mel, your switch is...
An overshow, I believe it was.
Mel, your switch is failing. Mel, your push-to-talk switch is failing.
My finger failing. I'm sorry. Yeah, I saw the light jump when I was just not paying attention for a second. Fractal geometry, Dick. Did you happen to catch that show, over?
Absolutely. Saw it 3 times. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of questions were asked. I guess a number of people saw it the first time, and they were amazed to see that Pam came on and was talking about fractal antennas. Now, I believe you and I both know that person, that Ham. Am I correct, over?
I sure do. N2IY. I sat in front of him a couple of years ago. Go ahead.
Called N1IR. I don't know. Are you sure we're talking about the same person, Chip Cohen?
Absolutely. Yeah, N1IR, Christopher. Wait a minute now. No? N1IR? Christopher Johnson, that's the wrong one. What did you think the call letters were?
I remember his call letters, I believe, were N1IR. Chip Cohen, actually his name was Nathan, but I remember talking to him. He was in Massachusetts, Dick, over.
Yep, he's right in downtown Boston. I visited him roughly 2004, sat in front of him for a couple of hours. He was about to propose... He was proposing to build a fractal version of the three-element Yagi antenna that we were using at that time. That hangs on the front end of one of the products. N1IR is Christopher Johnson, wrong guy. Maybe it's N2IR, even though he's a number one. Nope, Lester Lawrence, wrong guy. We haven't got the call letters right, but it was Nathan Cohen, and... He runs a nice company called Fractal Engineering or something like that. And he makes some very nice military vertical antennas for multi-frequency use in military applications. Back to you, Mel. We don't have the call letters right yet.
Yeah, I could have swore it was a 1. He was in Massachusetts. What if I got wrong? It was a N1LR? Gee, isn't that funny? It just jumps out of my mind right now, his call letters. Well, anyhow, a lot of people ask me questions, you know, if we could just break down what is fractal and how does it come to antennas and everything, because, you know, most of the show dealt with fractal geometry as it was applied to a lot of special effects and computer animation and all as they were demonstrating. And here, all of a sudden, you know, this... Ham comes on and tells a story about how he had to come up with an antenna that he could get away with at his QTH there. So the questions were, I guess, people were taken completely by surprise exactly as to what is all this about.
I tried various combinations of call letters, and I then tried Nathan Cohen. There is no Ham with those call letters, with that name. I hope he hasn't allowed his ham radio license to lapse. If you just search Cohen itself, there's a zillion Cohen, so that's not going to help. I think his first name was Nathan, and he called himself Chip. That's the same guy here. Back to you, Mel.
The definitely. N-A-T-H-A-N. I'm sure that's the spelling. C-O-H-E-N. It was his last name. Yes, I doubt if he gave up on ham radio. He was a young fellow at the time, you know, and I met him, so he'll be back, I guess it's 95. About 1995, Dick. It was for an unrelated situation, and not antennas for amateur radio use, but it was for transmitting actually video, surveillance video, an antenna, compact antenna system that he was basically offering. He did go in, I think, into the business. Am I correct, over?
Well, without a doubt, he opened up a very nice company in the Boston area. As I said, I visited him roughly 2004 and sat down with him for a couple of hours with some of the other people at the organization I work with. He had some very successful designs. He had a staff of people. He had an antenna anechoic chamber on the facility, a small one. He was linking together a large number of individual computers, making a supercomputer to do all the calculations of the fractal antennas to solve the individual problems that he was addressing at that time. And I just tried Chip Cohen, got no results. I tried Nathan Cohen, N-A-T-H-A-N-C-O-H-E-N, got nothing on that. What other spelling of his name do you think we should use, Mel? Go ahead.
Two I-L.
Go ahead, sir.
Bernie, how about W-1-Y-W? William 1, Yankee William.
That could be him. At least he's got the right name. Nathan L. Cohen. Whiskey 1, Yankee Whiskey, which is maybe a brand new set of call letters. Let's see if his previous call, if it tells us. No, it doesn't tell us what his previous call was. I'm not sure this is the same person. For all we know, there are multiple Nathan Cohens. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, 2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Google Nathan Chip Cohen of Fractal Antenna Systems, Inc.
Okay, and when you did you get Whiskey 1 Yankee Whiskey?
Affirmative. The first link is it's a discussion on the QRZ forum, and they speak of this gentleman of Fractal Antenna Systems.
Yeah, when we saw the program, he showed us an example on the PBS program of one of Chip Cohen's antennas, and written right on the print circuit board was N1IR. Quite possibly that was his call letters then, and he has changed since. So any ham radio operator would immediately recognize what was printed across the printed circuit board of the antenna. As I said, I sat down with him for a couple of hours, and when it comes to monopole, dipole-like antennas, fractals have a lot to offer. When it comes to Yagi-like antennas, I have reason to believe it does not offer a significant advantage. Nathan proposed to make a sample for us before we arrived, and he wasn't able to do that in time. And then he was proposing to make one at a later time, and to my knowledge, it never happened. So when it comes to multiple element Yagi antennas, I'm not convinced that Fractal can help. But when it comes to a single resonator type antenna, I think it can do some beautiful things. Back to you, Mel. Drag your feet in case Bernie wants to say some more things. K2KEY with a little delay, K2RIW.
The only other thing I'll add is if you Google Fractal Antenna Systems, it is a company. If you look at their About Us link, the chief executive officer is Dr. Nathan Cohen. Educated out of Brandeis, appears to live in the Boston area. The website is www.fractenna.com, so fractenna.com. Back to you, Mel. I'm clear.
WB2BS.
Mr. BSO, go right ahead. I'm not doing a Google search. There we go. Google search at this time.
Yeah, do you have time for one more unrelated question and comments on RFI issues?
VSO, you're going to have to do something with your signal. It's fading out. Go ahead.
Frank, WB2BXO. I just changed positions a little bit. Are you copying me?
Yes, we are, Mr. BXO. Go right ahead.
Okay, say again, we have time for an unrelated question and also for a comment on an RFI issue that was in the paper today.
You got it.
Okay, very good, Dick. Ran into an issue with Comcast related to HDTV. Maybe not strictly technical, but maybe somebody here can point me in the right direction. We have two boxes at our house in Philadelphia, which has Comcast service. One is a digital box. The second box is an older analog box. The analog box stopped working properly recently, not surprisingly, because of the digital conversion. It'll work, but not properly, jumping channels and stuff. Comcast came for a service call, swapped in an old digital box, presumably at no charge, since all we asked for was for our service to be working right, and not for an upgrade. And then, of course, they charged us for the additional digital service on the bill. And according to what I've read online, they're not supposed to do that. And they say to not be charged, we need something called a digital adapter, which they don't have yet. And I, as best I can tell from an excerpt that appears to be from an FCC order that was in a Wikipedia article. Wikipedia, of course, is not a great a great source. That if all we want is for our analog service to work properly, then they can't charge us extra to do that. That's my first question. If anybody has a comment on whether I'm correct or not on that, go ahead, Dick.
I don't know if I've got an answer for that one. How about you, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have no idea. You know, this whole business, again, boxes converted and all this stuff is seems like still a lot of chaos going on, Dick. So I have no answers for it. I guess Eric may be able to give him more info on this. Over.
Yeah, I don't think Eric signed in tonight. Looks like you got a tough one there, Frank, and I don't know what to suggest.
I'm here. Okay, you're doing good.
Go right ahead. I wonder if you heard the question.
Yeah, I did. The cable system. What cable system is it, by the way?
You got it, Frank.
This is Comcast in Philadelphia.
Yeah, they're playing a game with you. They probably... I don't know what they're doing in Philadelphia, but the laws are that if they're going to change from analog to digital TV, because what they're trying to do is recover some of the bandwidth in the cable, but they're supposed to give you advance warning that they're going to delete channels, and that they still have to offer the basic analog service. So the fact that they switch boxes on you and then charge you for it, I think that's against the rules.
Okay, very good. That's what the Wikipedia article said, and though it wasn't 100% clear, it appeared that that their source was an FCC report and order. All right, thanks very much. Eric, you're about the most reputable source there is on this, so I'm going to go with that. My other comment was, for those who noticed it in the Sunday Times today, it was an article about an RFI problem in Brooklyn where somebody's cell phone turned on their Magic Chef oven. And evidently this was also covered on 1010 Winds last week. And Magic Chef is winding up, Maytag is winding up having to replace the oven at no cost because this problem has been documented. And I just want to comment that, well, I'll kind of throw it out there that if this was somebody's ham station and not a cell phone, I'll bet the Maytag and everyone else involved would swear up and down it was the ham's fault and not their fault.
What do you think of those apples, Dick? And did you see the article in the Sunday's Times? So go ahead.
I'll take that for a second.
Go right ahead. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to go look for it. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, it's been around for a little while. A guy puts his cell phone on the oven and turns the oven on. I mean, if you've ever looked at the RF that comes out of his cell phone, it looks like pulsed energy, you know, because of the digital nature of the way the cell phones talk back to the command on the command channel. And, you know, nobody in the past has ever thought, well, you know, I'm putting a little computer in my oven to keep track of the time, turn it on, keep track of the tension, temperature, rather. And the manufacturers at this point never consider the fact that, you know, RFI. I mean, it's like if you touch something and it hurts, usually the cure is not to touch it. But the reality is, you know, okay, you're going to put your cell phone on the frickin' stove where it's going to get nice and cooked anyway. You know, I mean, it's the cure, of course, for that. It's put your cell phone on the stove. You know, it's only within a foot, I think, was what they were saying is what actually happened. So, but the appliance manufacturer is getting a little bit of a kick in the butt because, you know, there's your reality. K2RW, K2J.
Good old electromagnetic interference. Any further questions or comments, Frank?
That's about it. I just find it a pleasant change at first. Even though, admittedly, it sounds like the guy was too close to the stove when he answered his phone. And who's going to think that I'm too close to the stove when I'm answering my cell phone? It just seems refreshing that for a change, somebody blamed the consumer electronics device and not the radio transmitter. If it were one of us, they would be blaming us and demanding that we pull down our antennas and get our blankety-blank station out of the apartment building. Am I right? BB2BXO. Have a good night. 7-3.
Oh, you're right, Frank. We'd be the victim. I was on another repeater today, and a person brought to my attention that YouTube video, which shows three or four cell phones on a table in front of some kernels of popcorn, and they turn on all of the cell phones, and the popcorn starts popping. And there's four versions of that, one version with Americans, one version with Germans, one version with Scandinavians, I think one version with Southeast Asia people. And you rapidly get the conclusion that, yeah, they change the brand names of the cell phones, they change the costumes on the people, but they didn't change the table. You rapidly get the impression that they're not really traveling to these places to do this experiment. And if you go to Snopes, you'll discover that that's an extremely well documented farce. These people were creating a farce. They created a video for a joke, but it wasn't clear. Some significant number of people believe that cell phones put together like that will pop corn. Craziness. If you took kernels of popcorn, put them directly in a microwave oven, turned it on at 750 watts, the popcorn will not pop, not even in a microwave oven. The package of popcorn that you buy has a carefully worded message on the side of the package saying, this side down. When you put it in the microwave oven, there is a resistive strip inside of that package, which is RF absorptive. It gets hot from the microwave oven. It, in turn, heats the butter, which in turn heats the popcorn. As far as the popcorn is concerned, it thinks it's on a frying pan when it's in your microwave oven. Each one of your kernels of popcorn is about an eighth of an inch long. The wavelength of the microwave oven is 4.5 inches. That little kernel of popcorn is much too small to absorb any significant amount of microwave energy if you put it directly in the microwave oven. Tell that to people and they think you're crazy. So, as I said, somebody again brought
repeater. Time out.
On another repeater today, somebody again brought that video to my attention, and they believed it as real. So the people who are running around the world with biohazard fear look at that and get alarmed. There's real biohazard fear in the town of Bayville, but I'll get on that on the next transmission. But on those two subjects so far, anybody with any further comments, give me a call that is right now, K2LIW.
K2LIW.
Go ahead, Bernie.
I just wanted to comment on the Wikipedia. I disagree with the gentleman saying that Wikipedia could not be trusted. I know of at least two local universities in which the library states, the PhD librarian states that Wikipedia is a valid source, and they say it's actually more accurate than the Encyclopedia Britannica. So just something to think about. I sure wouldn't take, you know, trust it for pop culture type things, but for technical information, it does seem to be fairly accurate. There's also a CNN video that talks about how they actually did the, how the company created that video. The people creating the video were trying to sell Bluetooth headsets. They're trying to convince you that your cell phone's bad around your head, therefore buy those Bluetooth headsets. I have not fully watched the video of how they did it, but it's out there.
Good information, Bernie. Quite often when I Google the subject, I will Google the subject and then put on the search word plus Wikipedia. I want the Wikipedia answer. My history is that on certain kinds of subjects, the Wikipedia answer is the one that gives me the best answer with the least amount of grief and searching in the shortest period of time with the greatest accuracy, is my impression. Now, Wikipedia also is essentially a peer-reviewed source on the Internet. So I think 99% of the data that's there is very good. I wonder if anyone's got any further comments on that subject. K2LIW. Okay, let me say a couple of words about the town of Bayville. The people in Bayville have all convinced themselves that RF energy is quite dangerous and it must be eliminated. Radio signals must be eliminated from their town. The majority of the people in the town of Bayville on Long Island, part of Oyster Bay, has sincerely come to that conclusion. They really believe that they're protecting their children if all antennas, anything that emits radio energy, is eliminated from their town. And they're pursuing that now for a couple of years, a sincere effort at reasonably large cost to remove the antennas from that town. I have friends in that town. I have attempted to speak to them on this subject, and they don't want to hear what I have to say. If anyone with the sound of my voice have friends or relatives in the town of Bayville, and with our radio experience, we as ham radio operators, might be able to slowly convince them that we can't absolutely positively guarantee that no one has ever had the smallest side effect from radio energy. Of course, we can't convince anyone of that. But I'm convinced that the cost-to-benefit ratio in favor of radio systems is so far to the good that to deny them is to try to go back to the horse and buggy days. The law enforcement vehicles that operate in Bayville do not have sufficient radio coverage. If anything, the number of law enforcement antennas in the town must be increased. Not only has the district attorney for Nassau County, but also the Department of Homeland Security has gone on record saying that this will take place. That if at worst the town eventually succeeds in trying to remove the antennas on their current lawsuit from the town, that Homeland Security and the district attorney has said that they will condemn the property, take it over by eminent domain, and put the antennas back with a vengeance. They didn't use the word with a vengeance. Those are my words. But they will put them back. Homeland Security is demanding that. So if you have friends or relatives in the town of Bayville, in a gentle manner, it would...
Repeater, time out.
In a gentle manner, in my opinion, it would be helpful if the people could be slowly convinced that the benefit of radio far outweighs the risk. And it is a small community, and the people have all convinced themselves that they're right. They feel that they're defending themselves from the outside world, the federal government and the county government, that is forcing more antennas to be placed in their town. That is their attitude. They sincerely believe they're protecting their children. The friends that I have in the town have ceased using their cell phones, ceased using their microwave oven, ceased using their PCMCIA card plugged into their laptop computer when the child is in the house, for fear the child will be exposed to the radio frequency biohazard. It's the emotional word RF radiation that's causing the problem, in my opinion. It's a vocabulary problem. Had we, way back in the dark ages of 1900, called it radio signaling and radio propagation and whatever, we would have been way ahead of the game. People are making the error of associating RF radiation with nuclear radiation, and their night and day difference. There's almost no relationship between the two. So this is an ongoing situation that, in my opinion, requires correction. So maybe you guys can help. And for any further questions or comments, give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, yeah, Mel, we've got about 20 minutes. You want to try another one of your letters? Oh, the fractal antennas. What fractal antennas are doing, mathematically, is meandering. Whenever you decide to take a antenna and radiate a radio signal, if it's not a huge rhombic antenna or beverage antenna, all reasonably small antennas must resonate first before they can radiate any reasonable amount of efficiency. So, to make an antenna, you must make a resonator. To make an antenna that's smaller than normal size, you must resonate something of a smaller size. You can make objects that are smaller than a normal antenna size into a resonator by using one of three things. Meandering, spiral winding, inductive coils for loading, top hat capacitors, high dielectric constant materials, or high permeability materials. Any of those techniques will work. Well, one of the techniques for meandering, making the electrical length longer than the physical length, is fractaling. And fractal is a kind of mathematics that'll give you a meandered signal path. Therefore, a smaller package can't hit resonance. You end up with an increased Q and a smaller bandwidth, and that's the laws of physics. The Chu-Wheeler criteria dictates exactly how much the Q must increase as you physically make the antenna smaller. Chu and Wheeler wrote their two individual articles in roughly 1947 on that subject, and no one has found any errors in their criteria ever since. So fractal is one of the ways, and Nathan Cohen with his fractal antenna company sells antennas that use that concept, and he uses multiple linked together computers as a method of solving the exact equation that will give you your particular performance for your particular antenna and your physical space. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, you know, fractal geometry, I guess the person that brought it, you know, into the foreground now of, you know, modern day uses the Benoit Mandelbrot. He actually defined, fields, you know, he actually found it was mathematics from over 100 years before him. And then he got it together and came up with a number of formulations. Well, I guess we got to really basically, to explain it, I got some questions. I got a number of them, people that asked questions here. You know, up to now, we've actually recognized that antennas basically that look like lines, look like plane circles, triangles, squares, ellipses, rectangles, hemispheres, paraboloids, you name it, and all. And actually, I guess we based most of it was based on, I guess we called it Euclidean geometry. But Maxwell's equations, I guess, always, ultimately, I guess Maxwell's equations actually determine the radiation characteristics, you know, of an antenna. So, even though, I guess, simple structures and all, for simplicity, they're still got to, I think, behave to a certain amount as Maxwell really laid it out, I think, Dick. I don't think you can really deviate too much from what Maxwell's equation showed. Am I correct, over?
Maxwell did his work around 1860-something. At that time, radio did not exist. Maxwell did not write those equations to explain radio and to design antennas and design transmission lines. He designed a certain branch of mathematics, and as many mathematical breakthroughs take place, quite often the mathematics comes first and the application of it comes later. To my understanding, that's what happened with Maxwell's equations. Maxwell's equations to a circuit that has inductance and capacitance and maybe distributed length is the equivalent of Ohm's law. Every circuit that you and I design that maybe has integrated circuits and resistors and capacitors, if you properly apply it, Ohm's law is going to be effective in your circuit. It's going to be not violated per se. Does Ohm's law help you design your circuit? Well, not necessarily. Is Maxwell going to help you design an antenna? Not necessarily. There are modern computer design techniques for various kinds of antennas. The be-all, end-all program used to be HFSS, High Frequency Structure Simulator. It appears as though that particular $50,000 program, let me drop, is being substituted by a more modern program called CST Microwave Studio. Probably another $30,000 program, but CST Microwave Studio is now doing a better job of modeling two- and three-dimensional objects that you wish to use as radio components and/or antennas. So these modeling programs, with their optimization techniques that are built into them, sometimes even using genetic engineering principles, can help you design an antenna and optimize the antenna. Is that program using Maxwell's equations? Well, there's not a direct answer to that. You talk to somebody who feels he is skilled with Maxwell's equations and ask him, did he use that to design his last antenna? And you'll get a very peculiar look on his face and you'll get an indirect answer. You could say it's at the foundation of the way magnetic fields and electrostatic fields behave and interact. You can say that. But does it give you a nice, clear explanation for how to design or optimize an antenna? I'm very skeptical. I don't think we can go quite that far. Maxwell never intended that, and the art and science that we're now talking about didn't exist when he did his very pivotal work. His work really describes the way the energy relationship takes place between circuits that store inductive energy and circuits that store capacitive energy. But that in itself is not quite enough in my mind to help you design an antenna. And until recently, even the computer modeling programs don't help you enough on how to design an antenna. The last two and maybe three antennas that my name is on for the patent in the last couple of years, and some of these antennas are now deployed products in the commercial world. Some of those antennas have, obvious by the patent, very desirable performance across an extremely significant frequency region. And I have taken those successful antenna designs that were designed on my desktop antenna range at my place of business. I've taken those antennas and had skilled people put them into the best modern computer modeling programs, and the computer modeling program said nothing significant is there. Yet in the real world of measurements, the antenna has fantastic performance that didn't exist before, as part of the reason the patent was granted. What I'm indicating, and what Kent Britton, WA5EJB, indicated in the last lecture that he gave at the Central States VHF Society in 2009. In July of 2009, he gave a lecture, and the main meat of the lecture was, be careful with these computer modeling programs. They help you, but they're not the be-all, end-all. After you use the computer modeling program to get into the ballpark, you will then be using post-computer optimization, PCO. In other words, you as a ham radio operator are going to go in there and tweak and tune in order to get the last little bit of performance out of the antenna, because the currently available computer modeling programs, with their errors, don't get you to home plate. They get you into the ballpark. They do not get you to home plate. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, the only reason I bring up Maxwell, because, you know, he actually had, what was it, four equations that fit the bill to a great extent in the experiments that I believe were done previous to him by, was it Hertz? Who was the other person? Who was the other person who worked with Hertz? What the heck was Nick? Was it, I think it was Lodge. Was it Lodge was the other person that worked with at the same time as Hertz, Dick, over?
There's a lot of people. Hertz, Maxwell, Faraday, eventually Marconi. There's a whole list of names of various people who made contributions. Marconi is given credit for inventing radio, and he put it all together. He took the Hertzian dipole and somebody else's loop and somebody else's resonating coil and so on, and made a transmitting receiving radio system. But he was standing on the shoulders of many other people, so I'm not sure of which name you're looking for, but there's a lot of names really involved. There's a lot of simultaneous breakthroughs that were taking place around that period of time. Back to you, Mel.
I remember somebody that worked with Hertz at the time. Seldom is mentioned. I just happened to think of his name. I thought his name was Lodge. He worked with Heinrich Hertz. And Maxwell, I guess, James Clerk Maxwell came after that, sometime after that. And his prediction, actually, I think, was that component, local oscillating electromagnetic field, would not actually be retained in a matter of the local induction field. In other words, what would radiate actually into space. I think that was the work that Maxwell did. So Maxwell, I understand he came up with what? The four major equations which govern mathematically the formulation of electromagnetism. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
Sort of, yes. But in order to really radiate a signal into space requires something called the Poynting vector. Can you infer the Poynting vector from Maxwell's equations? There, I'm not sure. So, did Maxwell define radiation and propagation of a radio signal? I'm not sure. You talk to any person who's got 30 years of experience in the real world of designing antennas, and if you ask him how often he has used Maxwell's equations, the answer you usually get, well, I designed the antenna. My boss wanted me to write an article. I wrote an article about the antenna, describing its construction and its performance, its measured and its anticipated performance, and maybe its modeling techniques. And then I threw in some Maxwell's equation material after the fact in order to make the article sound sufficiently erudite that the IEEE Antennas and Propagation or Microwave Theory and Technique magazine review committee would select the antenna, would accept the article. The vast majority of real antenna designers and radio circuit designers do not use Maxwell's equations per se. It's a little bit like the lamppost to a drunk. You've heard the example. A lamppost to a drunk is as useful as, a lamppost is to a drunk as, I can't even forget the exact equation, the exact funny statement right now. It'll come back to me later. It's used more for support than for illumination. So Maxwell is giving you a foundation, but it's too many steps back from the reality. I could teach you computer engineering today by teaching you the way you take silicon and refine it to make P-type material and N-type material, and you make junctions and transistors and FETs and whatever. If you're working in a foundry that designs the products, the integrated circuits, that's useful.
Repeater, timeout.
In the foundry, that's useful information. But in the real world today of designing computer circuits, you want to know what brand of chip from brand A and what model number of chip from brand B I can put together to have the right fan out and the right interfacing and the right speed and so on. So in both cases, that particular piece of information is too far back to the beginning compared to what you do today. That's a strongly felt opinion. Back to you, Mel, K2LIW.
I was curious because, you know, Maxwell equations for waves in free space was actually a published book, and I was wondering where that stands now. So in other words, it is not really used, you say, in any modern designs, the equations that he had, the Maxwell equations for waves in free space, Dick. In other words, you feel that that is no longer a viable formulas to use in any kind of antenna designs. Is that correct? Over.
I didn't quite say it's no longer useful. What I did say is that a modern-day designer, for the most part, is not using them in the original form or even in the modern-day forms. They come in differential form, integral form, and so on. I worked for an organization with 1,050 engineers. 15 of them worked for the antenna engineering department, and the average of those guys had 20 years' experience. I saw no evidence of them being used on a day-to-day basis to solve antenna engineering problems for multiple military programs and commercial programs. I didn't say they're not being used. I'm saying that all of my experience, my 35 years of experience, I do not see evidence of them really being used before the fact. I see evidence of them being used after the fact, being used for support but not illumination. I mean, we've all seen that cartoon of an Einstein-like character in front of a blackboard with some really fancy equations. At the bottom right-hand side of all these fancy equations, it says, then a miracle happens here. It reminds me a little bit of that situation. It's just not the way it's really done. So I have seen no evidence of them being used in all of my 35 years of experience. Now, maybe I've led a very sheltered experience, commercially and militarily speaking, and maybe I'm an anomaly, but I've never seen it being used. I've asked lots of people, and I get funny answers when I ask that question, Mel. You've probably asked the question a number of times. How often have you used Maxwell's equations in the direct design of a radio circuit or an antenna or a propagation prediction? When you ask that question, of all the acquaintances you've had, Mel, even on the air, commercial world, whatever, I'm very curious as to what answers you're likely to get. Back to you, Mel. And we've got 3 minutes left. K2LIW.
I guess the only way that we can actually say that we've used recently Maxwell's somewhat modified or Maxwell's equations is because of the use of a toroidal coil. And it is directly a toroidal coil because the circulation of the magnetic field in a toroidal coil is actually the direct work, I guess, that Maxwell did in that field of electric field displacement, Dick. And I think that formulation for use in toroidal circuits, I believe, is a direct outgrowth of Maxwell's work. Am I correct? Over.
And now I'm going to agree with you, Mel. As I said before, Maxwell's equation does a beautiful job of predicting the interaction of stored energy in a magnetic field, stored energy in a capacitive field. Electrostatic stored energy and magnetic stored energy. and the interaction between those and resonance and whatever. So in LCR circuits, yes. But when it comes to real antennas and real propagation, I haven't seen evidence of them really being used. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, no, it's funny you're talking about this because I'm actually putting a generator together, and I found it to be very useful, especially the magnetic part of it.
Okay, so interaction of electromagnetic, magnetic and capacitive circuits. But would you use it for the design of an antenna, Eric?
Well, after listening to you for so many years, it's just, you know, antennas are like an art, and you just got to have the right feel for it, and, you know, in your life experience, it kind of puts it all together.
You got it, Eric. It is a black art. And in order to design antennas, would you be willing to make a Faustian bargain? Thank you, Eric.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could see RF radiation? Then there'd be no guessing, would there?
Can you imagine trying to figure out how those photons flowed through the ether or the phlogiston to get from the Apollo astronauts on the moon through that vacuum of space into my homebrew antenna on Earth? Can you imagine trying to figure out how that energy got transferred when not one single electron left that antenna? Over to you to explain that one, Eric.
You know, you got about a minute left, and I'm not even going to try because it's just, you know, if you got 10 engineers, you can get 10 answers.
You got it. You guys have wasted your time, so to speak, listening to TechNet number 1259, I think it is. That started in September of 1982.
12 a.m. 70. And good night from the W2VL repeater.
Okay, the only way that you guys are going to hear me is if I go to the other repeater. So goodbye, you all. We'll be back next week. And I'm going to have to say goodbye for Mel because he can transmit on 146.2585, which means it will come out of the 147.375 machine. But you will not hear it coming out of the 8.5 machine. So only if Mel can talk on 147.375 machine would we ever hear him. Good night, Mel. Good night, all. We intend to be back next week. K2RIW clear with K2KEY. Yeah, we can hear you coming out. We can hear you say good night. If we listen out of the other machine, Mel, and if you could transmit on 147.375. We hear you all the way. Bye-bye for now, Mel. Just say good night. Good night, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.
Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. I think it's K-A-2-I-R. K-2-R-I-W, go ahead. Yeah, but I know for a fact that not one single electron left that antenna. A bunch of electrons bounce back and forth between different portions of that antenna. That, in turn, set up a strong current, an RF current. That, in turn, created a strong local magnetic field. And by some kind of magic, that got transmitted. When it comes to a magnetic field, what does that consist of? When it's going through a hard vacuum of space, what in the world is it? It's a darn interesting question. And the answer ain't clear. Now back to you, sir.
Perhaps it's just energy converting into matter along the way.
Oh, John, we're going to query you next week and see how much...
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Just tonight, before, I was listening to TechNet and playing with the antenna on the rotor, and I put the antenna at a bearing of 030 degrees, and I was able to lock up on WFSB Hartford quite easily, and I put it back to 280 degrees, and I was getting CBS in Newark at the same time. Either go one or the other.
Yep. I've obviously got to use a higher gain antenna and a better location
with a rotator. Got to do all of the above. I've got the resources, just got to go and do it.
Well, that brings up a question for TechDana next week. It's called antenna directivity. What you see on a piece of paper compared to what you get in the real world. And that should be a good one, because it's about my TV antenna.
Understand. Now, your TV antenna, when you purchased it, quite possibly the manufacturer told you its gain, told you its beam width, and maybe supplied you a polar plot of its antenna pattern. Do you have reason to believe that what you experience with your rotator closely follows their published results? Go ahead.
Well, that's very hard to say. What I'm basically talking about is the front-to-back ratio, specifically. And I don't want to keep on this thing because I know you probably want to duck out of here and go do something else, but it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It seems to be very different than what the publication is. I think the publication is probably something like 20 or 25 dB front-to-back ratio. And I don't think I'm getting that. I think it's a lot less than that, like probably in order of 10 or 15 dB.
Yeah, and there's a lot of explanation for that one. The multipath characteristics of the stuff in your neighborhood is a big factor. We'll get into that next week. Enjoy. Bye-bye for now, Joe.
Joe Freeze, W2YY.